Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us. Thousands of Marylanders with developmental disabilities like autism, Down syndrome, hydrocephaly, or cerebral palsy are currently waiting to receive services from the Developmental Disabilities Administration, which is part of the Maryland State Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. They already have been deemed eligible for services, but because of a lack of funding, services that would help them with the tasks of daily life remain unavailable. About 100 individuals are in urgent need. They are homeless or living in temporary housing at risk of physical harm or of causing harm to others. Their caregiver may no longer be able to meet their needs. Each year, individuals with developmental disabilities, their families, and advocates travel to Annapolis to ask the legislature for funds. This session, legislation was introduced to make funding the Developmental Disabilities Crisis Waitlist mandatory in future years, exactly the kind of directive Governor Hogan objects to. The governor addressed mandates at a press conference in early March.
I've made it very clear that reducing these spending mandates should be the top priority of this legislative session. I was elected to bring fiscal restraint and balance to Annapolis and to hold the line on spending. To sustain the progress that we've made over the long term, we simply cannot return to the practice of recklessly spending beyond our means.
We asked Deputy Secretary Bernard Simmons, who heads the Developmental Disability Administration, to participate in this conversation. A spokesman for the Department of Health said the department could not comment on pending legislation. So with me here in the studio today is Christine Marchand, Executive Director of the ARC Maryland. The ARC is a nonprofit that supplies services, administers scholarships, and advocates for the developmentally disabled. Christine Marchand, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very glad you could be with us. Tell us about this wait list.
Well, the waiting list, as you mentioned, are over 8,000 people with developmental disabilities. Some who have been waiting for services for more than 20 years. There's someone in every single county waiting for services, their children, adults, and family members. What are they waiting for? They're waiting for in-home support if it's a family of a young child, respite care to be able to get some time away, out-of-home residential placement, independent living, day programs after someone graduates from special education, and employment. It's an array of supports that help people be the most productive and contributing and independent to society.
A couple of questions. First of all, you were just describing the overall wait list, correct, of something like 8,000 people. Are we talking primarily about children when we're talking about developmental disabilities?
Primarily adults, actually, okay, on the waiting list. There are about 2,000 children on the waiting list, and the rest of the people would be adults.
And let's zoom in on the crisis list, because that's what the particular funding argument is about right now, I think. Tell us about that list, how one gets on it, what it means to be on that list.
Well, first of all, the state determines that you're in that crisis list. You don't just sign up for it because you think you have that crisis.
And what makes a crisis in the state's estimation?
It has now, because of the lack of funding, gotten to be actually people that are homeless. We find many people that have been living with a caregiver that dies. No one even knew that they had a son or daughter with disabilities.
Why didn't you take a swig of water? Sometimes it is a situation where a caregiver can no longer give care or, as you said, dies.
Absolutely. We've had a family this past year. She was diagnosed with inoperable lung cancer, raising her adult son alone. She was in her 60s. She asked the state for help as she was going through her chemotherapy, and she was told by someone that unless she was in the hospital or dead, there would be no support for her son. She came to our developmental disabilities day at the legislature and spoke before 500 people, and she died a week later. And her dearest hope was that her son would have services before she died, and she was able to realize that when the state stepped in once they found out about her need. But these are serious situations. These are people, women that are going through breast cancer treatment, but because they haven't been told that they have 6 months to live, they're caring for an adult child going through chemotherapy. These are very significant cases, very serious.
In the case of the death of a caregiver, I mean, this is obviously not a point of discussion. The care that was being given is not, it cannot be given. So if there isn't funding for through the crisis wait list, what happens in that case?
Those individuals, typically the state finds some emergency money to cobble together something. The problem is, think if you're a 50-year-old person with Down syndrome who's been living with your elderly family all your life, they die, that's tragic and traumatic, and now you're uprooted from your home and cobbled together in some sort of housing where you don't know anybody and you don't understand what's going on. And that's the real tragedy also of the waiting list. To force people until their families are dying or dead in a crisis situation to get something at last is traumatic for everyone.
That is Christine Marchand, Executive Director of the ARC of Maryland, the nonprofit that supplies services and advocates for the developmentally disabled in Maryland, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. You can be part of this conversation. How do we balance responsible spending with meeting the needs of Marylanders with disabilities? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Senator Guy Gazzoni, a Democrat of Howard County, introduced a bill to fund the wait list, the crisis wait list, in future years. That bill passed the Senate yesterday 41 to 4. Late yesterday, I asked Senator Gazzoni about his bill.
First off, it should be very clear that this is a mandate, and it mandates funding for individuals who are on the crisis waiting list, individuals with developmental disabilities who need these services and need them immediately. It's $3.5 million a year, and it goes on out into the future.
I was under the impression that Governor Hogan included this funding in his budget this year. Wasn't that enough?
He did. Well, here's the problem. It has to occur every year, and it has to occur every year because there are new people coming onto the list every year. And the people who were on the list in the year before have to have their services continue. It's not like you can provide the services 1 year and they're out of crisis and they don't need housing anymore, because they might need housing or they probably will need housing. You have an adult whose parents have passed away and they may not have anywhere to go. Well, those folks are in crisis. They need service in that year, but they also need service every year after that.
But this has been the failure to come up with the funding for the needs on this list. I mean, there has been a waiting list for years, if not decades, during Republican governorships, Democratic governorships. Why do you think this is the right time, with this particular governor's attitude toward mandates, the right time to try to have this argument?
Well, look, we are coming out of, haven't completely made it out of, a very difficult economic time. And it seemed to me that if we don't do it now, if we don't look at the costs, look at the benefits to our overall society right now, when the economy seems to be improving a little bit, we won't ever do it. And as you point out, you're right, it hasn't been done over many years under many administrations. You know, I think the right time is any time. I just happen to believe that we need to be doing this now because we can financially, and we should be taking the responsibility. You know, last year, we actually put money in the budget for this also, and it was fenced off for these purposes. But the governor chose initially not to spend the money for this. Ultimately, he came around, and I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful the government came around there, and I'm grateful that he came around and actually included it in this year's budget. But it raised in my mind this idea that of leaving a community in sort of confusion as to whether or not money will be there for such a critical use. And so that's what spurred me on. That coupled with the economy getting a little better, this is, you know, this really should be the time to move forward.
Senator Guy Gazzoni, a Democrat, we spoke yesterday. Governor Hogan has not made a public statement about the developmental disabilities budget. When he was asked at that press conference in March about mandated spending for behavioral health services, another kind of social spending, he said he has to focus on the needs of the whole state.
I think we increase spending on behavioral health, but you know, those couple hundred people have an issue that they care very strongly about. I'm talking about what, things that 70% of people in Maryland care about.
So, Christine Marchand of the ARC Maryland, when you hear that, what is the message to you about how you what you need to convince the public of?
The thing is, this is a balancing. We believe this is what government exists for, the people that are most vulnerable in society. These are families that have cared for their sons and daughters all their lives. They rejected the doctor's recommendations to institutionalize their child. The young families are growing up with inclusive education. They have a positive, bright future. And yet if they stall out after their son or daughter leaves special education and sit on a waiting list for 10 years, regressing, watching TV, families having to quit work, these are not made up stories. And this is what we believe government exists for. Governor Hogan has been very supportive of developmental disabilities. This year, he funded the emergency needs and crisis resolution to the highest extent that's been done in many, many years. He is open to us for employment initiatives. We just have to think that this is a bipartisan issue where all parties recognize that this is really why government exists. And if families can't count or know that this funding will be there when they need help the most, they will have no hope, no reason for any relief.
We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll continue with Christine Marchand of the ARC Maryland. We'll also meet a young man whose brother is on the wait list. How has uncertainty over funding affected his family? How has his family struggled to provide a stable home life for a loved one with autism? You can join our conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. About 8,000 Marylanders with developmental disabilities are on a waiting list for services. A smaller group, about 100 individuals, are considered in crisis, meaning they may be homeless or not have a caregiver who's able to support them. Advocates are pushing to make funding mandatory for the most urgent cases. Christine Marchand, Executive Director of the ARC Maryland, is with me, and I'd like to introduce Andrew Barnhart, whose brother Adam is on the wait list for services. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us your family story.
My family story is kind of unique. I have an older brother, Michael, who is 25. He has Down syndrome. I'm the middle brother, I'm 23, and my younger brother, Adam, is 20, and he has muscular dystrophy and autism. And we've been, you know, on this wait list for about as long as Adam has been around. Michael has been on it probably once before. I don't remember when he was, but I know he's been on it at least once.
And let me make sure that I understand. When you say we've been on the wait list, this is the overall wait list for some services or the crisis wait list?
Crisis wait list. But we've not been designated as in crisis.
Oh.
Specifically, Adam has been on this crisis wait list, but he's only been under prevention, which is the next tier down under
crisis prevention, not crisis.
Not in crisis.
Not okay. So what is it that Adam needs?
Adam is, well, he has muscular dystrophy and autism. So with muscular dystrophy, your muscles are basically atrophied. He cannot walk. He requires a wheelchair and 24/7 care. With his autism, he basically has screaming fits, self-mutilating behaviors, constant chatter, basically echolalia, which is basically constant repeating. And he has just basically trouble getting around and being able to do things on his own. And with muscular dystrophy as well, it adds on top of that problems breathing. He has to be on a ventilator at night in order to remove carbon from his lungs. And he has trouble doing basic things like bathing, eating, sleeping, all these things he has trouble doing and needs assistance with.
So who's been providing that assistance?
Everyone.
Adam is how old again?
20.
20, okay.
Yeah. Everybody in my family has. My mom, my dad, and I have. We've all pitched in somehow, some way. Say, like, when I was younger, when we all were younger, mom and dad were working, I don't know, somewhere between 12 jobs between them, just to pay medical bills, pay mortgage, pay car bill, insurance, all this other stuff. So while they were out working all the time, it was my responsibility to watch both my brothers and make sure that they were taken care of and make sure that, you know, they were happy and healthy.
Wow. And so that's what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of that time, you said Adam has been on a wait list. Is the problem getting more urgent now? And if so, why?
For Adam, the problem has been getting more urgent because his condition continues to deteriorate, as the condition with muscular dystrophy tends to happen with individuals. And his autism has also become more and more severe. So he continues to deteriorate in health.
And are your parents continuing to be so involved in his care?
Yes, all the time. They're now divorced, but they continue to be greatly involved in his care. And we do our best to try and manage co-parenting. But it's also very difficult because he does require 24/7 care. And now that he's actually graduating from special education, Adam has nowhere to go during the day while my parents work. So now we're trying to set up support broker services where either I or my mother or my father will become Adam's support broker and hire job coaches to help him go out into the community during the day while we all go to work and then come back home later at night where we continue to care for him.
Obviously, this is not a phrase most of us are familiar with, support broker. It sounds like you're saying you would be the manager of his care? Not necessarily the one who gives it, but the one who makes sure someone's there to give it?
Basically, support brokers are people who are certified to help manage support for the person who needs the care. What support brokers can do is that they can help hire people to help manage care and help get people into the community, and they help manage the finances that come from the state for that service.
Well, is your family getting any help, any payment for those kinds of services from the state?
Very little, if at all. But none for the waiting list specifically. It's a completely different service. There are so many different kinds of services, it's hard to keep track. And that's what makes it so confusing. And
And thus the need for a support broker.
Yeah.
Christine, can you give us some idea of the kinds of costs we're talking about? I know you're not an expert in Adam's case, and I wouldn't want to give dollar and cents about Adam's particular needs anyway. But these kinds of services that Andrew's been describing to us tend to be what kind of cost burden?
First of all, the sooner you intervene in supports, the less expensive it is. So what Adam,
why is that?
Because you're able to support a family while the integrity is still there and the family is still there. So what Adam and Andrew are talking about are some basic supports to bring in job coaches to help during the day. But if something happens to the family, then you're looking at a full residential program, which I believe can be over $80,000 a year. The supported employment piece, which is what Andrew wants to help with now, is about $15,000 a year. So you compare, if you help a family before they're in crisis or get some respite supports in the home, it's much more effective in the long run and much less cheap.
And if a family, if faced with the kinds of challenges that Andrew's been describing to us, if a family says a residential setting is the only, we can't do this anymore, we're out of this, is that are they also then looking to the state for funding of that residential setting, or
yes,
or is that something the family themselves would have to come up with the money for?
A family could not possibly afford to pay for a residential setting. I mean, this is lifelong once the person enters the program.
Is there a federal component to any of this?
Yes.
Does the federal government pay for any of the kinds of services that Andrew's been describing to us, or for residential setting?
Yes, roughly half, a little less than half, is matched by the federal government. This is a Medicaid waiver program. So an example we have when you talk about residential are siblings. The families die out of state. They've cared for their son or daughter all their life. And mom's in New Jersey and has just died, and the sibling lives here, an adult sister. This woman testified at the legislature this year. They take their brother in. Parents are working, they've got teenage kids, and what are they going to do now? And he's no longer homeless, so who's going to support him? And the family has rallied around to try to support him. The state is immediately trying to intervene and help them because they recognize that a sibling is a temporary setting. But this is the kind of situation that happens when a family is asking for residential support.
Well, and so I'm trying to, the example that you just gave was a real example from the legislature. It's not the Barnhart family. It's not Andrew's family, but I gather, if I'm following you correctly. So in that case, does that family of this developmentally disabled person who is new to Maryland but has family here, is that person trying to get funding through the crisis wait list? And if so, do they go to the bottom of the list and wait?
The waiting list is very interesting. It sort of gets shuffled according to urgency of need, which makes sense. But you don't really know where you are on that waiting list. If someone comes along that is much more needy, they have to shuffle the list a little bit. The family that we just talked about, New Jersey, brother comes to Maryland. Right now, this family is just looking for some in-home supports, supported employment, so their adult brother isn't sitting around all day watching video games and TV and gaining weight. They'd like some in-home support. They'd like to try to care for him, but they're honestly saying, how long can we keep this up? Families began reforming, and this man is now in his 50s. Does he want to be living with his sister for the rest of his life? And I think that's something that we also don't look at enough. The person with the disabilities, they want to be productive. They want their own life. And if you can imagine the tensions with a 40, 50-year-old man living with his 60, 70, 80-year-old mother, you know, the tensions that start happening, it shouldn't be a mother and son relationship, caregiver like that for all those years. And, you know, as people get heavier and older, how many years can either party, you know, coexist like this? When is it time for the person to have their own life?
This is Midday on WIPR. We're talking about developmental disabilities, thousands of people in Maryland on a wait list for services, including about 100 individuals in crisis, and a proposal in the state legislature to mandate that about $3.5 million a year, at least for those families in crisis, be mandated in the state budget year after year. Adam, you were sort of nodding as Christine was speaking when she was talking about tensions in the family. Well,
yeah, there.
Andrew,
yes, there are a lot of tensions in families with developmental disabilities. It's at least it's not uncommon anyway. For instance, I love my brothers deeply, but there are times where, you know, when your brother has been screaming for hours at a time, where you just feel like you want to break down.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where I yell back at my brother, and we have screaming matches too, like, you know, normal brothers do as well. But at times it's hard to deal with those sorts of, you know, tensions. And it's just anyone who is a sibling of someone with a disability understands that there are tensions.
Christine, while you were talking about the Medicaid waiver, we got an email from Melissa, and she acknowledges she gets pretty detailed here, but she says it's important. So let me see if I can share her question. She says she's confused. She said the state reformed its community services Medicaid waiver. It should guarantee services for individuals with Medicaid who are at risk of being institutionalized and provide them with home and community-based services. I know that not everyone with developmental disability is on Medicaid, but many are covered through Social Security disability. State plan services are not optimal. They are supposed to be guaranteed. I know this seems archaic, down in the weeds, but this is very important. Is the state not complying with its own federal Medicaid waiver? So I guess her question is, if we're talking about people in crisis not getting funding, is that a violation of the state's agreement with Medicaid?
I'll try to take a crack at this without getting into all the weeds. There are a number of waiver programs, as Melissa has identified. The one, Community First Choice, offers a limited array of supports that are mandated in the state plan. So anyone that is eligible gets to receive those. But those are typically not developmentally appropriate. They're more geared for elderly people. The state is required to provide the supports through the Medicaid waiver based on the number of slots that the federal government approves for them. So if there are fewer slots than people that need it, they are not obligated to provide it. It's not a mandate that you have to serve everyone. So that's why the governor's budget becomes so important. Whatever the governor puts in the budget allows us to match with the federal money, allows us more slots to serve more people. But if we don't have enough slots, the waiting list keeps building up. So Melissa is completely accurate on some of the programs, but Maryland is not obligated to provide services unless they have all the funding.
Gotcha. Joyce has called us from Lanham in Prince George's County. Joyce, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Joyce. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and support the message that is being discussed here. I work with a number of people who live in Prince George's County. Our agency serves about 2,000 people, about 600 who are on the waiting list. And right now, we have 80 people who are in that crisis prevention category that was mentioned earlier. And, you know, you hear crisis prevention, and you may think it's not really a crisis yet. But I just wanted to share that, you know, these are some really untenable situations, and the need is great. We have an 18-year-old who has a single parent. She is unable to work because she can't find someone to stay with her daughter outside of school hours. Her daughter does engage in aggressive kinds of behavior. She isn't able to communicate with words, which is really difficult. She needs some services to help her with that. She needs in-home support. She needs to learn how to go out into her community in a safe way. we're working with somebody who's 50 years old. Their caregivers are elderly now, and this woman, she has medical needs. She needs home modifications. She uses a wheelchair. She's completely dependent for her ADLs. She's 50.
ADLs.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, activities of daily living. But her parents are quite elderly, and as Christy mentioned, when do they get a break? It shouldn't be at the point of their demise.
Joyce, I appreciate your calling and telling us about this. How, Christine Marchand, from your perspective, working with 10 ARC chapters around the state, how widespread is the issue of aging caregivers? Is that a big part of the problem we're talking about?
On the crisis resolution list, the list we've been talking about, the most urgent, 70% of the caregivers on that list are 70 years old or older. The next list down, crisis prevention, which Andrew's family is on, 50% of the caregivers are over age 70, and 52 of them are 91 years and older. There are 100-year-old families still caring for their son or daughter. And current requests, which we haven't even gotten to, that's you need supports now. I think of current requests like special education or public education. You get a public education because you need it, not because your families are dead or dying or getting to be 100 years old and you won't have anything. So the current request is people need supports. And on that list, 52 of the caregivers are 91 years old and older. They haven't even gotten to the higher levels. Also, to clarify, the ARC Maryland has 10 local chapters that provide supports, but the ARC Maryland is a statewide advocacy organization, so our constituency are all people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, and we work with consortiums and coalitions that are advocacy-based as well.
We need to take another short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about this issue of people with developmental disabilities waiting to get the services that they've been deemed eligible for. What is it like to care for someone with a developmental disability? What services are helpful for them to be able to participate in everyday activities and go out in the community? You can join the conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the developmental disability wait list, a list of 8,000 Marylanders with disabilities like autism or Down syndrome or cerebral palsy. These individuals may have to wait years to receive services from the state. As their caregivers age, their living situation may be thrown into crisis. I'm speaking with Christine Marchand, Executive Director of the ARC Maryland, and with Andrew Barnhart, whose brother Adam is on the wait list for services. You can join this conversation. You can send us an email to midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. We got an email from Jeff in Baltimore, and I don't think either one of you can actually answer this, but it echoes what crossed my mind also. Jeff heard me say earlier that the State Health Department, which includes the Developmental Disabilities Administration, told us they couldn't comment on pending legislation. And Jeff says, doesn't make sense that DDA wouldn't comment on pending legislation. It's not a lawsuit, and they are not lawyers. If reporters can't get this information, what does that say about regular people being able to get answers? I don't know whether either of you want to address that, whether getting information from the Developmental Disabilities Administration is difficult.
I guess I just want to say this is not a blame game. This is about resources. The state would love to provide the supports. They're the ones hit every day with the latest crisis call and trying to figure out what to do. People want to help, And that's why we have this legislation, to make this mandated so you don't have to worry every year and the state has the resources that it needs and probably wants to do. So again, we don't want to be blaming the state. It's that their hands are tied with what resources they have.
I think a lot of people here, year after year, 90-day session of the General Assembly, all kinds of lobbying for all kinds of things, you know, lots of sometimes partisan wrangling, lots of stuff goes on. Eventually, some kind of budget is set and the state goes forward and life seems to continue. And so they may hear, okay, so every year these families with developmentally disabled members have to go and lobby. You did that this year, Andrew. What's involved in when you have a developmentally disabled family member in showing up to lobby a committee in Annapolis?
It can be kind of difficult to do, depending on who is going to go and lobby. If it's, say, just me or my mother or my father who go and lobby, then obviously that's easier to do, but it doesn't necessarily send as powerful of a message. My family and I testified for Senate Bill 413 and House Bill 1499. My mother testified for the Senate bill. I testified for the House bill.
These are the same substantively the same bill in the two houses. Yes.
Yeah. Correct. And I remember taking my younger brother Adam to the Senate version. That required staying in a hotel overnight and waiting to the next day in order to go to Annapolis and testifying. But that night, Adam had one of his screaming fits, and we were scared that we might be kicked out of the hotel. So I even offered to take Adam back home to Hagerstown into Western Maryland, which is also kind of a long drive from Annapolis, about two and a half hours. And but eventually we got him to calm down and sleep again. And we managed to get through the night with little sleep, but we managed to get through the night and testify the next day. And I think it resonated a lot, much more. It resonated much more with the representatives that were there.
That's quite a burden on the family.
It can be, yeah, especially if you're from parts of the state that are not so close to Annapolis, like Western Maryland or even southern parts of Southern Maryland, where it takes a long time to get to the Capitol to lobby.
And you're from Hagerstown?
Yes.
Tell us about Michael. You mentioned your older brother, Michael.
Yeah, my older brother, Michael, who's 25, he has Down syndrome, and he works three jobs now.
Works three jobs?
Mm-hmm. Part of the community in Hagerstown. He works at Ace Hardware. He works at a retirement home, volunteers there, and he also volunteers at the local library.
And he just goes off and does this, or does he need some support to do this? How does this work?
He has a job coach, and this was what I was mentioning earlier with the support broker program. My mom is his support broker, and she hired, basically Michael had to start a small business and hire a job coach in order to assist him going out into the community so that he can, work and be an active member of the community. And this is part of what we are trying to realize for Michael, to be an active member of the community and to be as independent as he can. And eventually we want to, our biggest dream for Michael and Adam eventually too, is to have them live independently, even though they may need some help. But independent living is our ultimate goal for them.
We had a call from Paula in Frederick, and I guess we've lost Paula. And I'm trying to remember. She was on the board of a hospital and created a crowdsourcing platform for families. I'm sorry I didn't get to Paula before we lost her, because I can't quite picture. Christine, have you heard of this kind of thing, going outside the system for funding?
That's wonderful. Kudos. I think that type of fundraising could help. Families need money for summer camps. They want inclusive camps, Y memberships, respite care. I find it hard to believe crowdsourcing, crowdfunding raise enough money for the full residential supports. But many times it's those small interventions, just knowing that for 2 weeks in the summer, your son or daughter has a stimulating camp program or swim lessons or music lessons to be more part of the community could be wonderful. I hope your caller calls back and tells us more.
Paula, if you're still listening, call us back. Andrew, the job coach that your brother Michael works with, is his or her, I don't know whether it's male or female, but is that job coach's time paid for by the state?
I'm not too sure of the details on that. This was something that was done with Michael fairly recently to help him get to be a part of the community. I'm not too sure about the details of the job of a job coaching program or the support broker aspects of that. That's all my mother's doing, and she's the support broker. And I've been away from Maryland for about 6 years or so. I've been, 4 years in Massachusetts pursuing my bachelor's and 2 years in the UK doing my master's. So
your master's is in what?
Bioethics, which is ethical issues pertaining to biology and medicine.
Uh-huh.
And my specialty is in disability and enhancement.
I can imagine. What are your dreams for yourself? Where do you see your life going?
I would love to pursue any kind of career in ethics. I love to think about issues of right and wrong. So if I could, say, work at a university and continue doing research in the field of disability and enhancement, or working on other ethical issues that are, pertinent to today's society, I would love to do that. But it's hard for me to say that that dream will always be real, will be realized, because there are always days where I think, well, I'm either going to have to uproot my life and come back home, come back to Hagerstown, and make sure that my brothers are adequately cared for, because my parents are obviously not going to be around forever, or I'm going to have to uproot my brothers' lives and
move them to where you have an opportunity.
Yeah, to either the UK or to somewhere else wherever I'll be.
Christine Marchand from the ARC Maryland. Paula's reference to crowdsourcing or looking for outside money to make things happen for the developmentally disabled reminds me that I imagine some listeners are listening to this year-by-year struggle over funding for the crisis wait list and thinking, well, why not a dedicated source of revenue for that budget so that it's not a yearly fight? Has there been an attempt to do that before?
There are some small funds that are dedicated sources. When a state institution closes and the property is sold, that money goes to a trust fund. Thankfully, with that trust fund this year, 24 people will get supports. Not too many, but those 24 people, it means a lot to. The alcohol tax that I believe it was in 20...
I've forgotten to.
10 provided a one-time shot.
An increase in the tax.
In the alcohol tax, uh-huh. Thank you. A one-time shot for 250 people. So a dedicated fund would be great. It's where does the revenue come from for that?
I thought, Andrew, you looked expectant.
I thought
had something that you wanted to add. What does the year-to-year nature of this funding mean for families?
This is so difficult. There are two areas we really follow in the budget. One is transitioning youth. Those are students that leave special education at age 21. They're the students with the most significant disabilities. Michael is one of those, Andrew's brother. And it used to be that these students would graduate in May, the state budget was adopted in early April, And they didn't even know if there would be support. And thankfully, for the past 15 years, that funding has been relatively stable. I think the legislature and the administration has come to understand why that's so important to continue the investment in the children and youth as they now leave school to get jobs. But, you know, it is so difficult each year to identify families in crisis and bring them down to Annapolis. Not only the logistics, working families, older families, non-English speaking families. And if you've been to a hearing, you sit in the hearing, especially the budget hearings, you can sit there for 4 hours listening to the analysis, the department, until it's finally your turn.
That's a whole separate reform that's needed, is why why all the hearings on a certain day are alleged to start at the same time when clearly they can't. But
right.
Your point.
Right. But it would, if we had the resources we could count on, just like we can count on other parts of the government to know that it's there for this 100 people, it would really take the burden off of these families.
Andrew, what is it that you think the public doesn't understand about this situation? Or do you think people do understand it pretty well?
I think it's mixed. I think people believe that they understand the situation and say, oh, these are people in need, we need to help them. But they don't, they may not understand why. Or people may say, oh, these people are not really in need. There's other priorities that we have to set in front of. But we're not trying to pit this in terms of this is a greater priority than something else. This is something that needs to be done. But I think in order to have people better understand this problem, I think that what they ought to do is try and better understand people with developmental disabilities. And it's tough to, in my opinion, it's tough to try and understand people with developmental disabilities if you have very little interaction with them. And from what I have seen and from what I've experienced, people have minimal interaction with my brothers because mm-hmm. the way that they've gone through the education system, the way they've gone through society, they've been sequestered. They've been, you know, sort of pushed aside unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Not mainstreamed.
Yeah.
We have just a half minute or so left. Christine Marchand, how do you see this working out? You said this shouldn't be a blame game. But as I pointed out, this is a situation where Governor Hogan, who may be very sympathetic substantively, says he's against mandates. So what happens?
These families are terribly frightened that there will not be the funds when they need it, when they're in the most dire straits. And they love their children. They want to do best. They spent years caring for them. And they have hopes and dreams for their children. And we hope these can be realized.
I want to thank you both. Christine Marchand, Executive Director of ARC Maryland, thank you.
Thank you.
And Andrew Barnhart, whose brother Adam is on the wait list for services and whose older brother is working. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank The Veranda for providing lunch for Midday's guests, menu and catering information at theverandabaltimore.net. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Are you getting enough sleep? Do you wake up feeling refreshed? We'll speak to a sleep expert about how fatigue affects your health and what you can do to get a better night's rest. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.